Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. I travel a fair amount and in the process meet interesting people. Not long ago, I was returning by plane to Montana. I sat near a man wearing a camouflage hunting parka, middle-aged, African-American. We got to talking. In addition to being a serious hunter, angler, and outdoorsman, Dr. Les Peirce turned out to be president of Washington State's Evergreen College. Later, I came to his office to do an interview about Evergreen's unorthodox approach to education. And on one wall, I saw striking family photographs. These pictures tell an exceptional story about the Peirce family and about America. Les Peirce, many thanks for joining us again on Home Ground.
Oh, Brian, it's nice to be here with you, man.
Now, what we're going to do is talk about some photographs, which I need to describe to our listeners because they can't see them, and we'll just go one at a time. I'm looking at a picture, looks like maybe early 20th century, 19th century, of an elderly man with white hair, a white beard, very large hands, rough clothes, strong face. Who is that?
That is my great-great-grandfather, Rolly Peirce.
What do you know about him?
That photo was taken on the Gaymont Plantation just outside of Fredericksburg, Virginia, in Caroline County, Virginia, which is the plantation from which the Peirce family originated.
When you say plantation and Virginia, are we talking slavery?
Absolutely. This is a picture of him. It may have been taken after emancipation, but he stayed on and off the plantation after the emancipation most of his life. His son had a place very near Gaymont in the, after the emancipation.
What did you learn about him growing up?
Well, he was the one ancestor that we've been able to trace that is the foundation of the Peirce family. He had a son, John William Peirce, who was my great-grandfather, and one of his sons, my grandfather Lamar, was one of his sons, my great-grandfather's son. He was a foreman on the plantation for a long time. The family during the Civil War had written a book called Welcome Hinges. I think we have a copy of it someplace.
Your family?
The family that owned the plantation. I think it was the Pattons that had the plantation at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd written a book called Welcome Hinges. And it was a story about the life on the plantation. And in the track someplace, they refer to Raleigh, and they're referring to my great-great-grandfather. And they said, all is well on the plantation. Raleigh is in charge of all of the servants, and he has the gift of being able to get others to work diligently while doing little himself.
A useful skill.
And I thought, oh, the first administrator.
So as a child, you saw that photograph, I assume, at some point. What did it mean to you?
Well, it meant a connection that we had with our history. You know, it's rare that any African-American family can trace far back their history or lineage, certainly not to Africa or the original places of the homeland for people. But it's pretty exceptional, at least on that side, to be able to go back as far as we've been able to in terms of the history, given the history of slavery. But by the time in the middle 1800s, the plantation owners were required in Virginia to no longer list slaves as just like the pigs, 10 slaves. They had to have names, ages, and the census information. That's why we were able at least to track back through the census records to our great-great-grandfather.
All right, let me ask you this. You're learning about him initially as a small child. It's part of your family story.
That's correct.
As a child growing up in the 50s, what does slavery mean to you? How does it strike you? Your great-great-grandfather was a slave. Does it seem normal? Does it seem a terrible abuse? What's going on with this young boy's sense for this issue?
As a young African-American man, we had a keen sense around issues of inequity. We'd spend the summers on my grandmother's farm in Virginia. My dad worked for the Union Pacific Railroad eventually, and he had railroad pass, and every summer we'd take the train back all the way to Virginia, and I grew up on my grandmother's farm in the county where this was.
And this is segregated Virginia at that time.
It was in the 50s. It was segregated.
So you experienced that firsthand.
I experienced it firsthand, except people need to understand that African-American people tended to be very close with each other. They didn't – the kind of interaction you had with white people in the South at that point was limited if you worked for them or you had to go to the store and buy something. But other than that, your interaction was socially with – around African-American people. So I had little interaction when I was a kid with white people.
Okay, that's fair enough and fully understandable. But here's a kid – you said it in a previous show that we did with you about the university. You're raised in Idaho.
Uh-huh.
It's an integrated society.
Yep.
You're going to visit your grandmother or great-grandmother in a segregated society, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That had to be what for you?
Well, it was interesting. In the summertime, we didn't go into the school system.
Right.
There weren't very many social things that we encountered. The only experience I can tell you that I recall that had involved segregation when I was a kid.
Right.
We were playing one day, and we'd been cutting lawns for people, and we had to have change. And someone said to me, "Tommy, why don't you go down to the cafe down there and get change?" And so I went down, walked in the front door, went up to the counter, asked for change, and the place is full. All white people. I'm not thinking about
and
anything.
And you're about how old?
I imagine I was 8, 9 years
right.
old. And the woman started laughing. She said, "You must not be from here." And I said, "Oh, no, I'm from Idaho." And being me, you know. Oh, and everyone laughed. And the woman said, "Oh, well, here's this change, young man. I'm going to wrap it up in a piece of napkin so you won't get it dirty." And everyone laughed. Of course, I didn't. I thought, "Well, thanks." And I left. And it wasn't until later, a day or so later, when we were walking around and we wanted to get some soda, but I said, "Let's go in there." And my cousin said, "We can't go in there. That's segregated. Black people can't go in there." And I said, "Well, I went in. That's where I got the change." So that was what I encountered and the way they dealt with it. But that was a small Virginia town where everybody knew each other, white and black.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Dr. Les Peirce, president of the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, about his family history in America. Next photograph. I'm looking at a very strong, penetrating face, gaze from a woman sitting in a rocking chair, color picture, fur collar. My first thought when I saw this photograph was Native American. And then I thought, no, African American? Who am I looking at? Who is she?
Well, that's my grandmother, Naomi Thompson. We called her Birdie Thompson was her name. I took that photo of her when she was 96 years old. They had just named a major street in Pocatello after her, being one of the first employees of the city when they came at the turn of the last century.
Would you agree that's a keenly intelligent, penetrating gaze?
She's one of the most powerful people that I have ever met in my life. She was 4'11", and you would have thought she was 7 foot tall. The picture says it all about how tough she was. She had 9 kids, and during the Depression, she buried her husband and 3 of her kids all within a year and a half. She then, for the rest of her life as a widow woman, took care of the remainder of her kids and raised them. She had gone to Lincoln Normal College as a school teacher and a very well-educated woman and secretary of the Allen Chapel AME church all of her life, and lived this life of an educated woman that through her life did domestic work in order to be able to provide for her family because of segregation.
What was her ethnicity?
Her mother was Creek Indian. Her father was African American. She was born in Muskogee, Oklahoma.
And pardon my ignorance, the Creek tribe is from that area?
They were a part of the tribes that came out of the South during the Trail of Tears, when they moved all of the tribes out of the South to Oklahoma.
Trail of Tears is early 1800s, middle, post-Civil War?
It'd be before the Civil War.
Okay.
Jackson, I believe.
And you knew her well?
I knew her all, but she lived to be 102 years old.
Wow.
So and she lived by herself in her own house beyond her 100th year.
What did you learn from her?
most of my foundation and principles of living came from my grandmother and what she'd instilled in my mother. First was education. She was a reader, and she tutored all of us when we came from school. She would tutor us because she was a teacher herself. What a bonus. She used to take us around on Memorial Day and put flowers, wildflowers, on all the graves of all the people that helped her after my grandfather died. Bankers, lawyers, and her message was, remember those that have treated you well in life and the importance of remembering your family and people once they're gone. And she would do it by having all of her grandkids trailing behind her, and she'd talk about each of the people as we put flowers on the grave. And then she would say, do you see anybody else's flowers on this grave besides us? This was a great banker. He was one of the most wealthy people in Pocatello. He did these wonderful things for me. Look at his grave now. We're the only ones that are doing something for him. So she taught us the continuity of the connection between, you know, the sense of obligation, and not only in the society, but the sense of goodwill and remembering the obligation that you have to remember and to honor.
You mentioned your grandfather, and I am looking at a photograph. I'm going to say it's like a newspaper photograph, a guy on a bucking bronco, classic pose. The right hand is out with a hat. The horse is bucking. His left hand is forward on the neck. The guy on the saddle is African-American, bleacher behind full of people. That's your grandfather?
Yep, Tracy Thompson. He was the saddlebrock champion of the state of Idaho in 1930. He navigated all of the kinds of challenges one might imagine in that kind of profession. But my grandmother always said, he's just horse crazy. She says, I can't describe her. And she'd have a twinkle in her eye when she talked about him, because it's clear she just loved him to death. She says, I get up early in the morning to start the wood fire, and your grandfather would already be coming in. Some colt he tied up outside and had to tie it up to break it, get ready to get it broken. Everything was horses, horses, horses. And when the rodeo season came, him and the Edmos, who were Choban Indians, would be on the circuit going to all of the rodeos around.
Where was he born?
We aren't sure where he's born.
Where did he grow up?
We don't know. He died in 1930 in Bozeman, Montana, in a rodeo. Someone cut the cinch on his horse saddle. And when he came out of the chute, he broke his neck. It was drug. His friends that traveled with him brought him home that weekend after that.
You're saying someone deliberately...
Yes, yes. I mean, as near as we... I mean, there's no question that his cinch was cut. Why, it's not clear. But yes, he was killed.
Did she tell you any stories about him in terms of how she got to meet him, how he got interested in horses?
Well, she was always very vague. But whenever she talked with great, great joy about him. And I said to her one day, and she must have been in her mid-80s, I said, we called her Ninny. I said, well, Ninny, I said, how did a school teacher end up with a cowboy? And she's laying in her bed, and she looked at me, and she got this twinkle in her eye, and she says, oh, I don't know, Tommy. I guess the cowboy just made the school teacher throw her books out the window. And then she just roared and laughed with this just wonderful laugh. I've never forgotten it. I guess the cowboy just made the school teacher throw her books out the window. So they followed the railroad out. They were in Denver for a year, and my first uncle Lester was born, and then they moved to Marsh Valley just outside of Pocatello, and they were there on a ranch for a number of years before they moved into Pocatello. But they followed the railroad. In the winters, he worked on the railroad, worked in the gravel pits, and did other jobs.
Huh.
But always broke horses for doctors and lawyers. And, you know, he was a horseman. He broke horses and made money breaking horses for people.
And loved to rodeo. Obviously.
And then when spring came and the rodeo season started, Tracy Thompson was gone.
African-American cowboys are not part of what I'll call mainstream history. What do you know about his reception as a cowboy? Any racial discrimination? Any or not? Or what happened to him?
Of course, cowboys, being African American, Hispanic, or poor white people, were very common in reality, because being a cowboy was the lowliest job there was. Cold, wet. So there were a lot of cowboys, but being a rodeoer where you're riding for prizes and competing at that level is a different kind of deal. And I asked my grandmother one time, well, how did he do there? And she said, well, some rodeos, they wouldn't let him ride in, or else sometimes, you know, they'd call him Snowball, or he had these names, and sometimes he would do work as a clown for bull riding or something in some of the areas. But that's all she had to say. But by her implications, it was clear that it depended on where he went in regard to where the reception was. But he was a pretty outgoing guy, and I understand was generally very well received and had a lot of friends in the horse business because of that.
You said, I think, that he was the champion Brock rider in Idaho, which obviously suggests extensive competition, and you got to be somewhat well-known.
Yes, I would think so. It's interesting. We've particularly around Pocatello, the War Bandit Round up in Idaho Falls, and he rode in the Pendleton at some point as well, I understand. The details in regard to all his riding, and, you know, they came to Idaho 1910, 1909, so he was riding from that period to 1930 until he was killed. And, of course, the rodeo business was just emerging. Most of the rodeos were done in some canyon fenced in.
Right. And this picture, this is a big grandstand.
This is a big deal. That's in Idaho Falls. It's the War Bonnet Roundup. That's where that picture was taken.
So your grandmother and your grandfather had how many kids?
They had 9 kids.
Your mom is one of them. We'll get to her. Who are the others?
Well, there were 4 boys, Lester, Albert, Wesley, and Tracy, whom we called Uncle Spuds. He's the only one out of all of my uncles that isn't buried in Pocatello in the same cemetery my grandmother and everybody else. He's buried on Queen Anne Hill. He died here in Skid Row in the early 70s, Tracy did. One died in his late 50s in San Francisco. He was a public servant's bus driver, and then my Uncle Wesley came back from World War II and was never quite the same. He was the infantry guy, you know, saw combat.
Segregated infantry.
Well, World War II it was. You know, he saw combat and had some ill effects from that, I think, that
I
really were tied to. It's interesting. I talked with the wife of one of my uncles, Albert, who was in San Francisco, and he was one of the first African-American bus and transit drivers. And, of course, you had to be able to take the civil service test to be able to qualify at that time. And I remember her saying that, oh, yeah, you know, he could read and write so well. He was so well-educated. He got the highest score on the test, and they had to hire him. And so he worked as a bus. He worked as a transit bus and on the rails there in San Francisco for most of his life. I knew him the least out of all my uncles. But he died at his mid-50s or later of alcoholism, as did all 4 of them, actually.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying that 4 of your uncles were alcoholic?
They all died of alcoholism, or the effects of alcohol, yes.
When you and I talked in our previous interview about your background and your presidency of the college here, you indicated that your parents instilled in you the fundamental importance of an education. Now, did that come from Grandma as well?
Well, it came from both sides, the Persons and the Thompsons, very much so. Both my parents were huge believers. They were high school graduates, but are not college graduates. They worked after they were married and never went on to college at all, but that was their expectation. And so, you know, that came from my grandmother on that side, and my father's people had very much the same values.
Okay, now I'm thinking of your uncles. Did they get the 4 that died of alcoholism? Were they educated men?
They all graduated from high school, but not only that, but they were all tutored by their mother when they were in elementary school, and because she was a school teacher who couldn't teach. But she, in terms of writing and reading and math and that sort of thing, and I said to her one time about education, and she said, well, you know, education is a double-edged sword, Tommy. And I said, what do you mean, Ninny? She says, your Uncle Wesley, who was a little older than my mother, she says, well, take your Uncle Wesley. When he graduated from high school before he went in the Army, he got a job working as a laborer. She said he was working for a week. At the end of the week, they gave him their pay, and he looked at his pay, and he got his pencil out. He said he had a tremendous head for numbers, and he calculated the hours they were going to pay, and he came up short, and he went to the boss, and he says, you said you're going to pay us this amount at this rate that should be this, not that. He brought the numbers, and the guy nervously paid him the amount that he had to. And then all of the illiterate people that were working there came over to this 18-year-old kid and says, figure mine out, which he sat on a rock and did. And they charted everybody. They had to pay everybody. And I always say this, you know what happened to Wesley? He got fired. And so my grandmother says, that must be a terrible thing to be punished because of the fact that you become an educated person. And I always remembered that.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Dr. Les Peirce, president of the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, about his family history. I want to ask you about your uncles. Four dying of alcoholism is outside the range of statistical probability. You're saying they were all able, and for their time, educated men with a solid high school education plus what their mother taught them.
Yeah.
What happened to them?
What I learned from her stories, the gift of education is the capacity to understand things, to be able to move into society, to read, to see what's coming, to be able to have the ability to be able to contribute, and to be able, ultimately, to be able to advance and be as successful as you can, given the skills you had. And I have posed the question many times to people, what must it have been like for these four men to have had that kind of education in the 30s at a time when there was this profound segregation in the West, where the opportunity to be able to move up a ladder and to have upward mobility was in your intellectually and in reality was not possible. And I have often thought that their alcoholism and what ultimately ended up happening with them was affected by people that understood a world and its limitations as far as they were concerned, and the fact that they were unable to be self-actualized as far as their ability and capabilities were concerned.
Now, at that time, the West was not legally segregated. I'm hearing you say your analysis of this is because they were African-American, even though theoretically there was not segregation, there was discrimination and opportunity.
Well, there wasn't only discrimination and opportunity, but there was segregation as well. In the 50s, there were many of the restaurants that would not serve African-American people. In Idaho, Montana, all over the West.
Yes.
Because many of the people that came out and established businesses in the West came from the South or carried that ethos. For example, you know, when my dad used to drive us back to Virginia in his car every summer, him and my uncle used to make this big deal. We're going to go all the way. We're going to go nonstop so we can get home in a hurry. That's because they didn't want to tell us that there were no motels that would allow us to stop and stay there on a trip from Pocatello, Idaho to Washington, D.C. That's the thing that people don't think about, is that there's formal segregation in the South, but de facto and policies that were carried into the, and there was housing segregation in Pocatello until well into the 70s. And after the civil rights movement, in terms of just the ability to be able to go and live wherever you wanted to, there was a certain segment where people were limited because of people of color, Hispanics and blacks. That was the area you lived in, and it was redlined. There was no, if you had the money, you would not have the ability to be able to buy any house that you wanted. I mean, those are just realities that are long gone now, but it was the way it was in the West as well. It's important to understand that.
When we first met, you told me this story, and then you played me a song that you felt, at least I think you felt, summarized perhaps the experience of your uncles. Fair?
Fair, yes.
Would you play it for us?
I'd be glad to. It's called Blue Wing. He had a blue wing tattooed on his shoulder. Might have been a bluebird, I don't know. Get stone drunk and he'd talk about Alaska, salmon boats and 45 below. Said he got that blue wing in Walla Walla prison. His cellmate there was little Willie John. Willie, he was once a great blues singer. And winging Willie, he wrote him down this song. It's dark in here, can't see the sky, but
But I look at this blue wing and I close my eyes and I fly away beyond these walls, far above the clouds, where the rain don't fall on a poor man's dream. Oh yeah, on a poor man's dream. They paroled old Blue Wing in August 1963. Moved on picking apples in the town of Wenatchee. The winter finally caught him in a rundown trailer park on the south side of Seattle, where the rains grow cold and dark. And he dreamt and he dreamed a vision when the salmon still ran free and his father's fathers crossed the mighty Bering Sea. And the land still belonged to everyone and there were still old songs left to sing. Now it's boiled down to this cheap hotel and a tattooed prison wing. It's dark in here. Can't see the sky, but I look at this blue wing and I close my eyes and I fly away beyond these walls, far above the clouds, where the rain don't fall on a poor man's dream. Oh yeah, on a poor man's dream. Drank his way to L.A., that's where he died. No one knew his Christian name and no one even cried. But I dreamt there was a funeral, a preacher in an old pine box. Halfway through the sermon, old Blue Wing began to talk. He said, it's dark in here, can't see the sky. But I look at this blue wing and I close my eyes and I fly away beyond these walls, far above the clouds, where the rain don't fall on a poor man's dream. Oh yeah, on a poor man's dream. Oh yeah. Poor man's dream.
I must tell you that if that was my family's story and that had happened to my relatives on the basis of their race, I would be an angry, bitter man. You are not. Why?
We have a complex history in this country. You know, we're all part of it. We're all part of this democracy. The challenge that we have is not bitterness. It is being able to figure out how we come to grips with and find peace with what our history is. That's the way I look at it. You do it through education. I mean, this work I love and the kids that graduate here every year, white, black, the whole range. I think that by experiencing this college and knowing me, it changes what is and heals and makes our society healthier. That's why I'm optimistic. I mean, you have to be, and I certainly am.
Dr. Les Peirce, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground again. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.